Welcome to the Faculty of Humanities and Social Science Research Podcast Series at the University of Nottingham, Ningbo, China, the first Sino-foreign university. I'm Dr. Mary Jane Ainslie, Associate Professor in International Communications.
And I'm Dr. Derek Irwin, Professor of Applied Linguistics. We're coming to you from the Language and Pedagogy Laboratory here at the Faculty of Humanities and Social Sciences.
For this edition of the series, we are delighted to be joined by Dr. Richard Freno. Richard joined the School of International Communications as an assistant professor in 2023 after receiving his doctorate from Griffith University, Queensland.
Now, prior to joining academia, Richard was the principal songwriter, frontman, and producer for the Sony Sign band Red Light Company. And I will say, when I read that the first time, I went down a rabbit hole on YouTube just checking it all out. So I do encourage our listeners to check out Red Light Company as well. So in that role, he achieved commercial success, propelling their album Fine Fascination to the 13th spot on the UK album charts. Red Light Company embarked on several international tours, headlining their own shows while supporting high-profile acts such as the Kaiser Chiefs, Editors, Kasabian, is that right? The Killers.
Yeah.
I'm just making sure I pronounced it right.
Yep.
I can pronounce U2, though.
Oh, yeah.
Coldplay and Snow Patrol.
You know, I deliberately gave you that bit.
I
wanted to hear you say
make
this.
Sure I'm really hip.
You did sound very hip.
Thank you. I'm working on it.
Yeah. Alongside his far-reaching impact on the music industry, Richard published the book The Music Industry in the Digital Age, How Platforms Are Redefining Pop, DIY, and Participatory Culture in 2025 with Bloomsbury Publishing. Okay, so Derek, I think when I talk to you about the music industry and the music age, then we're probably in sort of the age when, you know, you had turntables and all that. Kind of,
Where are you going with this? I used reel-to-reel when I first started my theater degree.
Uh-huh.
We actually,
did the movies have synchronized sound?
We were mostly silent films, but okay. You sometimes synchronize the sound with the piano player at the front of house.
Yeah, I thought so. because I was sort of reading this and wondering realizing just how much the music industry has changed radically. I mean, I study film and I study the creative industries, and I see enormous change having happened there in a very small amount of time with a huge amount of changing digital tech. But actually, the music industry almost seemed to have moved much faster in many ways. And I hadn't actually realized just how fast that was. Like, it was within my lifetime. You know?
You're so short lifetime.
My brief little lifetime on this planet. Yes. That I had seen enormous changes take place in this way.
Well, all of us have, right? And that's one of the cool things about this book is it kind of highlights how this is the beginning of what could be actually quite a substantial process even going forward. I'm sure Richard will want to talk about this a little bit more.
He probably will.
I suspect he will. And we should actually, full disclosure, Richard has helped us with the sound on this podcast as well.
He's kind of the reason this whole thing exists.
So without him, this wouldn't exist. So thank you for that.
My pleasure.
And it's about time we had you on here.
Yes, certainly. Also, I think what's important to state from that very kind of impressive biography that we gave in the beginning, we are actually talking about very, very, very much practice-based research here, an embedded scholar, which we don't often get, or we don't get enough, I would say. I mean, there's certainly a movement in this direction. We have kind of filmmakers now becoming kind of film theorists and film scholars and film historians and things. I'm coming from my own background again there. But I haven't seen that yet sort of in I would say musicology, although maybe it's more popular, maybe it's more prevalent than I think. But certainly to this level, I mean, reading Rich's bio, reading these achievements, reading just how embedded in the music industry he was. It's quite amazing, I think, to make that jump to academia. There were quite a few famous names that the kids will recognize.
I recognized a couple of them myself.
Did you now?
Yeah, that was crazy.
More hip than I thought.
So, Richard, let's drag you into this conversation. I mean, obviously, the title highlights this. Mary's point here is really good. That, in fact, having...
All my points are really good.
I'm sorry, they are all very good.
Yeah, thank you.
But the one that she brought up with you as a practitioner, but also a reflective practitioner, this, I think, really informs the book, and you front your own positionality right from the very beginning, which
I think
you is
were
important.
There when all these crazy changes were taking place, I guess, and actually kind of that's how you began, as I understand it, because I love the fact that Richard begins his book with basically him in his bedroom. Okay, sort of beginning.
Well, let's let him say this. So tell us about the role of MySpace in your career.
Yeah.
MySpace, remember that?
No, that's well before my time.
Well, I could say it changed my life. I mean, MySpace was definitive in terms of my career trajectory. I guess that's the starting point for the book, right? And that is also platform disruption, which is the fundamental engine behind all of this industry change that we're seeing. But for me, it was that ability from the bedroom to democratize my creative output and be able to almost game the system in a way of getting eyes on the music that I was making. The more work that I put into it, even if I wasn't the most talented, right, the more I see results.
You are pretty talented, Richard. Okay, like, let's not play that down at the start. Okay?
Well, there's certainly better musicians, you know, and more accomplished. And at the time, I was, you know, very much a DIY kind of bedroom artist, which now is a lot more prevalent, I guess, in terms of the way that artists operate than it was then. But really, I didn't question it too much because it was just the paradigm, you know, that I existed in as I came of that age when, you know, the music industry was, you know, at that point. So
give us a little bit of that story because you outline it briefly in the book and it is really interesting. So can you begin with Richard in his bedroom?
Yeah. So I started very young, maybe when I was 14, first computer I got. I, you know, the Windows, you could get you could only record one track at a time on the voice memo type app. So I didn't have a four track or anything, which is what most people would start off. So all of my recording journey started in a very digital way. And then I just built up these recordings kind of from the age of 14. I got really into it. I wasn't great in school, but I was really kind of engaged in terms of music. That was always a passion of mine from a young age. I started in bands, you know, 14, 15, 16, realized that was something maybe I wanted to do. I never had any ambition to be in the music industry of any success of that kind. I actually thought, oh, maybe if I get lucky, after doing a degree in music technology, I could make music behind video games. I thought that was a fairly reasonable request. So I went into creative music technology in Hull and I did a BA in that. I got lucky enough to contacted a ton of studios. I became a coffee boy at a studio in Cardiff. Just whatever they needed, I would go and
live
get
in the dream.
Yeah, exactly. funny story. There's a famous producer called Flood, who he's done U2 and Depeche Mode, and I worked with him briefly. But I came to realize the reason why he was called Flood was because he was such a good tea boy that he would constantly be filling up people's cups. So I thought it was some exotic.
Do you have a nickname somewhere in there, Richard?
No, maybe the one that I don't know.
I'm kind of wondering. Is this where we went wrong? Kind of, should I be knocking on the Provost door, you know, filling up coffee and tea?
I think you could have had a whole other level
the
of
niche
success.
I didn't get to that. I missed that one. Continue, Richard.
Yeah, so the coffee boy, you know, that was great. I was super excited when you're young, you know, just being close to all of this fancy equipment felt like a really engaging place to be. Very ambitious suddenly at the time. I saw all these bands coming in and out and I was like, this is something I want to do. That sounds great. So I'd stay late at the studio. I got the run of the studio out of hours. I would make all of these demos, writing this music, good and bad. But then the studio owner kind of was listening to it without me knowing, he would call up the projects and listen. And he actually sent the projects to a manager in London. He was the manager of quite a seminal band called McCluskey at the time. And he came down and met me. And that was kind of where it started. He signed me as management. I put a band together. You know, in my own kind of Svengali way, this wasn't entirely organic. You know, it was something where it's like, I need to achieve this. So I put adverts in papers.
But not totally manufactured. You weren't like a boy band.
Self-manufactured, yeah. I guess. It was, certainly
nothing
not.
Wrong with a boy band.
I didn't say
Jared.
There was. I was
I
simply
know there
trying
was a
to.
Noted disdain.
Not at all. I am a K-pop aficionado.
Do you even know what that
I don't, actually. Let's skip my comments. Please.
Yeah, very naive at the time, though. In many ways, that was born out of some decisions made. For example, I put an advert on the internet for a bass player, needed a bass player. Someone from Wyoming, the least populated state in America, replied. That was Sean, who ended up becoming the bass player in the band. But he flew over with all of his equipment in his suitcase with no money in his bank account and immediately got deported. And then we managed to get him back in the country to actually start playing, and he got some money in his account. And there was a kind of figuring it out, you know, and that was the kind of process.
You're smiling wistfully as you recount all of these details.
Yeah, I've said that story many times in interviews back in. It just reminds me of the interview process of being in a band, you know, and kind of the stories.
And now you are reduced to Mary and Derek. Where did it go wrong?
It's nice looking back on it. It's just that there's a distance of time, you know. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not a straight road, and I don't think any artists, you know, kind of have a direct path from, you know, one spot to another. Certainly it's going to be interesting, and I was extremely lucky. There was a space of 2 or 3 years in my life from that studio being a coffee boy to getting signed, to putting that record together, and it was just the right moment in the UK music industry where the MySpace bands were in vogue. You know, we could make a living out of touring, which is something I touch on in the book, which is much more difficult now. So I had far more advantages just because of the environment that I was coming out of. Learned a lot of lessons, and the one thing that it gave me was a really good base of people to talk to, and a kind of foundational knowledge of how all of that infrastructure worked. Even though it's very different now.
It's interesting listening to you because you sort of reinforce the way this how fast this industry is changing, in that you're sort of reminiscing about this and saying, oh, we did this, you can't do that now. And this is not that long ago still. But
no.
Ultimately, these kind of paths have changed so much by technological development. Before I actually get onto the book then, can you just finish the story and tell us, how did you then stumble into academia?
Yeah, stumble's a good word. I guess from being in the band, you know, we did pretty well. We got that record out, and you know, I made a bit of a name for myself. But we toured a lot for, you know, good solid 5 years of touring, which was quite exhausting, I'll be honest. You know, as much as I love playing live, I much prefer being in the studio and being creative. So that was definitely something that called me back. So from being in the band, I then went into being a co-writer and producer. And I then kind of worked with lots of pop artists. I was on Universal for a time and working with, you know, a little bit of a factory line process of, you know, new people every day and then also developing people over time. So that gave me even further insight into actually the mechanics of the pop industry, the mechanics of how artists build themselves through these participatory kind of exchanges, and how important it is to have that plot, that story. As I said, it was a factory line process. One thing about that is it can feel a little bit like Groundhog Day. And I got to this point a little bit where I thought, well, what's the end goal? You know, I kind of had my taste of a lot of the things that I enjoyed in the music industry. And there was that question. as you said at the beginning, wouldn't it be fun to be a somebody who had kind of a level of experience to then move into a space like academia where you could kind of have those conversations around it? So that was one of the main motivators, I thought. Are there many people doing this? You know? Mm.
The idea of moving into academia to escape Groundhog Day, though, is a little bit surprising. I mean, both Derek and I have been in Groundhog Day for quite a while now. Yeah.
We live highly stimulating and variated lives.
Indeed, we do.
Yes. Okay. Now, I'm going to pick up on something here, Richard, because I notice this kind of twin idealism and pragmatism actually also runs through the book. Mm-hmm. It's really interesting to see where there's this concept of artistic vision, but of course you're dealing with an industry and all of the challenges that can bring to a kind of creative mindset, but even the idea of distribution, so modern distribution channels like streaming and the like, you call a kind of democratization of dissemination, I suppose, or at least access to it. But then, of course, there's still gatekeepers and the algorithms and things like that cause issues. So I guess I'm while reading the book, I was often both uplifted by the notes of idealism and wondering if the challenges to them are too great.
I found that too. I thought the book offered a very good balance between both addressing the positive and negative effects of this change. I think you were very sort of careful to go over both of these and sort of saw how they came together in a package in this way. Could you speak a little bit about that and about those kind of changes, such as the issue of increased access that Derek pulled out?
Yeah, I mean, I think, as you said, intermediaries or gatekeepers is an interesting situation within platform disruption.
Can we define what we mean by it?
Yeah, so for instance, you speak about the algorithm on Spotify. That could be considered a gatekeeper in terms of access to large audiences. Mm-hmm. But there's another layer, which is another intermediary between them. We have platforms such as SubmitHub, where anyone can submit their music to lots of playlist curators, and then they'll get their music on a playlist. And that signals the algorithm to then say, oh, people are listening to this. I'm going to then put it on other people's Spotify playlists. So you have layers of an onion of how to get to your audience.
And in kind of Derek's age, the gatekeeper would have been one single person?
Yeah, it's more singular, isn't it? And also it's more tastemaker based rather than metrics, numbers, algorithms making decisions.
And so that change has
So these are people like DJs.
Do you know what a DJ is?
You're the one mocking my age. I sure do know what a DJ is.
Okay, I'll stop.
So at a radio station, who the record executives and you know.
And it's hard to see how that would make any difference to your career now, really. You want to be more visible online. I mean, even 10 years ago, you would have pursued blogs, online blogs, in order to get exposure, to drive buzz towards your band. But really, it's kind of driven more and more into irrelevance. And actually, the only metric worth pursuing becomes this singular Spotify metric in some ways, or TikTok, or whatever the platform of your choice is.
And there are lots of these platforms. As I was going through and I was, you know, reading about these, I was kind of picking which ones meant what. So YouTube, for example, there's been quite a number of stars discovered through YouTube. But how much of that is due to a visual aesthetic as opposed to a musical aesthetic? So I'm just wondering, you know, kind of casting us back to like a Marshall McLuhan, how much of the medium is the message and how much of it is the music?
It's a good point. There's a lot of baggage with platforms as well. The way that you're perceived if you break on YouTube is quite different to how you would be perceived if you broke on TikTok. And it's different format, isn't it? So it's a longer format. You're trying to build a world around yourself in terms of artistry. But there was a long time where YouTube was the place more than 10 years ago to break as an artist, but then it became a bit of a stigma after that. And actually, artists that broke on YouTube weren't seen in such a positive light as they might have been a few years beforehand. So it's almost like picking your platform is another thing you need to be very aware of as an artist, because they offer different affordances and different types of perception of what you actually are.
And would different genres be more applicable to different platforms?
That's right. So TikTok, which ended up being a whole chapter in the book, which is kind of crazy to think. When I started the book, I didn't think, but it just got to this point where I couldn't ignore it anymore. It had to be. And, you know, at one point, it was very much seen as the kind of dance video. Let's, you know, really over-egg the pop kind of market side. More and more, as I saw in the interviews, it became just this universal, you have to show up and find a way. You know, if you're not comfortable doing a dance, then find something engaging. But there's platforms that you just can't ignore. Mm. TikTok's one of them, you know.
You sort of begin your book looking at the early 2000s, mm-hmm. and you mentioned MySpace as being kind of the platform that sort of changed everything in many ways. But obviously, there wasn't just MySpace, as Derek said, and it didn't just end with MySpace, certainly. So I wonder if you could go over for us the kind of main technological changes and platforms that have influenced the music industry since the early 2000s and MySpace.
Sure. There was MySpace. I miss MySpace. I really mourn the loss of it, actually. It was a fantastic platform.
I jumped on yesterday when I was reading this, because there are artists that are predominantly MySpace artists.
So for sure. I mean, there was a whole glut of them at the time in the UK, and it became what was be called indie landfill eventually, where it was kind of cast
indie
aside.
Land.
Yes. It was. We had our day in the sun, and then But MySpace kind of really started it all, and then it moved over to Facebook. Almost overnight, it moved over to Facebook.
You mean music?
The music industry.
Okay.
I mean, where they wanted to show up and it forced bands to have to just follow.
That's interesting, because I didn't really associate Facebook with music.
You had to. So when Red Light Company really, we got signed off the back of MySpace, but we built our profile on Facebook eventually. That was because the platform just declined very rapidly the minute that Facebook showed up, certainly in the UK.
A cliff too then.
Yes. Yeah.
Right? Because I do remember the era. I was reliving some of the indie artists that I enjoyed yesterday as well. Yep. So I was digging through and a lot of them had Facebook pages, and a lot of them were linking YouTube videos through Facebook and things like that.
Yes.
But as Mary was saying, it would never occur to me to go to Facebook for music.
Mm.
Yes. Yeah. Now it would be strange. I wouldn't even update my artist page, I don't think, in terms of that. It just doesn't feel worth it. But I guess just as an aside, though, as an artist, you have to play to where your audience is. So maybe there's a Facebook niche that
the boomer audience.
So then it kind of proliferated, right? So we get to the 2010s, and it's all about hype, right? And blogs and all of these things. And that's, I guess, what I was touching on earlier. So there's a platform, Hype Machine, where a lot of the industry monitored these charts to see, who's showing up on Hype Machine? Who's getting this blog action? So we saw artists like Lorde kind of take off. Lana Del Rey was another example of somebody who, puts kind of enigmatic things out to just tease the world and but really not show too much face. And that became very popular in the early 2010s. So this fragmentation, independent blogs becoming this big thing online. And as, we see this ascendance of Spotify as this undercurrent that's kind of underpinned everything and this crescendo into basically that being the kind of dominant metric, really.
When did Spotify become dominant?
I guess it's become more and more dominant. I mean, when I was in when I was in my band, it was just starting around 2009 kind of time. But in terms of a dominant metric, it would be the mid-2010s, I would say, where you're really chasing getting on those good playlists, because people saw you can break an artist just off the back of one really good playlisting. Just like with TikTok, you can break very quickly off the back of one.
By break?
Yeah. So just getting that point where you cross over into, you know, I guess algorithm loves you, and then you get this...
You're viral.
Yeah, to a point. I mean, I guess that would be the word, isn't it? It's
because you do talk about memes and things like that.
Yes, yeah.
I'm going to just take a quick step back, though, because what we're missing so far is the existence of how music is disseminated, which I think fundamentally shifted as soon as we had things like the MP3.
Right.
So prior to the current era, you know, you could only have physical media.
Yes.
And so there were digital physical media with the CDs, but prior to that, there's cassettes and vinyl. And then once it became possible to have songs over the internet or digital transfers, that fundamentally shifted what it meant to have music, right?
Sure. And I guess Napster was the big shift, right? And that was the pre-MySpace groundwork that we needed in order to have that platform disruption occur. But it also completely ruined the value of music in terms of people's perception. The fact that you could, you know...
When you say the value of music, what do you mean?
Well, before you would have to... It was quite expensive in the UK to go and buy an album in a store, but then
monetary value.
Yeah, I could then go to, you know, Napster in 99, you know, and then it might take me 2 hours to download an album at the time, but it was free. And suddenly, music just didn't have that perceived worth that it did do before, which was an interesting kind of inflection point, and I guess the start of a disrupted traditional music industry. You know, that was the beginning of the seeds of the new music industry of how it was going to do.
I'm interested in this concept of worth, because you touch on an interesting point that you also make reference to a lot in your book, which is kind of the idea that we have access to so much more music, and you talk about the democratization of the industry, but then there's the question of quality control and the worth of music as regards quality, and there's a big sort of contradiction or tension, rather, perhaps, between those two things. And you pick on this a lot in your book.
Yeah, because democratization comes at a cost to an artist, I guess, in the sense that you're all feeding from the same trough a little bit, and there's more layers, but at the same time, there's a lot more competition. So does it result in greater creative output? I don't know. That's
how do you measure creative?
Exactly.
Output,
yeah. Yes. Yeah. And a lot of people think we're living in the best creative musical time. And then others would say that actually having those more traditional gatekeepers, those curators, the radio DJs, the traditional A&R, the tastemakers really helped to shape a less homogenized kind of perspective on what creative output would be in the zeitgeist of the time. So I struggle with that a little bit. I think it's something to wrangle with, and whether it's been a positive or a negative impact.
We do assume that democratization is a kind of positive way to frame something, but maybe in aesthetic terms.
I mean, democracy doesn't have the best reputation these days.
I am not going to get into that, but yes, certain republics who need not be named.
Moving on.
So, AI slop. I am, because you're talking about artistic integrity, we've now entered an era where with the push of a button, people can create something which may or may not be perceived as having aesthetic value certainly doesn't have any human soul behind it. Sorry, that's a weird way to put it, but the creator of it is not
demonic music.
Exactly. The computer is the demon. I'm not going that far. But what I am saying is I deal with AI in terms of large language models. I'm a linguist. And so very often what's being produced by these generative AIs is simple garbage. And I'm wondering of the effect to the music industry. I mean, you're talking about artistic value. Where are we headed?
It's a really good question. I've been thinking about it a lot recently with Suno. I mean, that's been the only platform that I've used in terms of AI to test the water in terms of what it's capable of, which is quite shocking when you consider where we were at with music just a couple of years ago in terms of AI generative. It can be quite convincing. We saw, I don't know if you saw about the band Velvet Sundown, there was a entirely AI-generated band with AI-generated artwork.
So this is like a Milli Vanilli for our time.
Right. And they did really well. They have millions of streams on Spotify. Nobody knew that they were AI Suno-generated, except for the fact that people started noticing that they were making basically an album pretty much every week. And they worked really well on the algorithm, right? You know, and it worked. Yeah. And they, if you go Velvet Sundown, I mean, I wouldn't press play because I don't want to send any clicks that way, but they have millions of streams. But then on the flip side, you know, there's an artist, Ariel Pink, very DIY bedroom pop. He co-creates things with AI. So there's a lot of sounds that you can hear on the record which you wouldn't know, but he's kind of used generative AI to kind of use that. And I think that's perfectly permissible, interesting. I mean, as long as the foundation is co-creative or generated by the artist. But I think the more interesting question perhaps with AI is if it starts training itself on itself. Right.
Yeah, we do have that in terms of these large language models now.
Yeah.
You have a Ouroboros of snake eating its own tail almost.
You worry if cultural production, because it is invading cultural production, music, film, you wonder what the future of that is if it's...
Does it veer off into its own? I mean, maybe we'll eventually have a genre that's identifiable.
I'm not as opposed to AI creatively as I thought I would be, having seen its potential in terms of as a co-creator. I think slop is definitely not to be enjoyed, but you know, there are moments where it's a very powerful tool. And if it stops people from having a writer's block or enables some creative output that wouldn't be possible, then I guess it can be quite silly.
Isn't the concern though the flooding of these channels? So you know, AI, because it's capable of producing so much, which, you know, not even considering the quality or not, it can overwhelm the capacity of humans to use these channels.
Yeah, I think certainly, and it's genre specific too. So if you look at lo-fi study beats, it's just the easiest thing to generate with Suno, and it sounds great. Why would anyone want to go and spend hours producing a lo-fi study beat when in that time you could just prompt hundreds of them, then create a playlist yourself? So I certainly think some genres, especially kind of vocalist genres, will really struggle. I don't think they've got a future.
These wider questions that you're addressing, you touch upon all of these in your book. And one element that I liked in the book was that though it's not just you and your experiences, which are great, that you are drawing on, but also you actually interview a lot of experts as well. So people you've known in your musical career and people at different points in people at different sort of levels and own different professions in the music industry as a whole. You interview them and you also draw on their sort of ideas too and their responses to the kind of questions that we're asking now, which I think added a great deal to the analysis, certainly. And you list them at the beginning. I mean, obviously, you don't give their names, they're anonymous, but you talk about, you list all of the people you interviewed, and they are sort of artists and managers and label owners and people working in different parts of the industry. How did you actually select all of these specifically? And because this must have taken a lot of effort to talk to them individually,
yep,
to go over the information they gave you at the same time. So I'd like you to talk a little bit about that process.
Yeah, I tried to get a reasonably even spread because everyone has a perspective in the music industry in terms of what's positive and negative. If you're an artist, you would see things very differently to a label owner. So that was, I guess, you know, one of the things about having that embedded kind of background was I have access to a lot of participants within the industry. I've worked with a lot of record labels from the co-writing and the producing side of my career. And I've worked with a lot of artists. So it was very interesting to see management's perspectives versus artists versus labels. If you as well look at major label artists compared to independent artists, they all have different layers in terms of the way that they perceive disruption and changes and how that might be positive and negative. But a lot of the people that I spoke to initially were for my PhD. And I got lucky in a sense because it was COVID at the time and people were a little bit more available and forthcoming in terms of speaking on Zoom.
Live events at a minimum.
Yeah. Yeah. So I did a lot of interviews for the PhD and thankfully a lot of people came forward for the book and then I added some additional people there. But you know, one of the people I interviewed, I think I'd name him there anyway, Derek G. He's quite an influential kind of tastemaker on platforms. He didn't really exist in terms of the role that he has in the music industry while I was doing my PhD. It's an emergent role. You know, he's very popular on Instagram, and becoming like the new radio station gatekeeper that you mentioned before. These people who are seeking out curators, they're seeking out somebody to tell them a little bit more rather than just this algorithm. They want to be told what's good, what's bad, or have an opinion at least. Mm. So that was an interesting addition. I thought he added a lot of value to the narrative there. Yeah. Mm.
That also brings me to another point that I pulled up on here, which is the kind of one of the major effects that this use of, you touched upon it earlier, multiple sort of platforms and the branding of artists. You talk quite a bit about the branding of artists and how now that is actually just as important, if not more important, than the music, and how that's something you do kind of yourself. But one issue that I pulled up and that was of interest to me in the book, particularly as a film scholar, was this notion of boundaries, personal boundaries and privacy being pushed to the limit in this way. And I wondered if there is a sort of a redefining in a way of what privacy is, of what the human is, of what the personal is in this way. And I also wondered if you kind of, as an artist yourself, also experienced this at all, because you do sort of pull it up in the book there.
Less so, I think, than probably artists today. I mean, I still maintain putting things out, and you have this chronically online need, mm-hmm, you know, just because that's what's required in order to maintain a presence as an artist, as a filmmaker, as anything within a digital economy.
I hadn't realized how much, I guess, that had changed, mm, and how much that was actually something that you saw much less, I suppose, even 10 years ago.
Well, you have more of a proliferation of platforms, right, that you need to service. So you need to create bespoke content for different platforms as an artist, which spreads you very thin. For instance, the format that might work on an Instagram reel might not be ideal for a TikTok video. Likewise, a YouTube video would be a longer format. So not only are artists spread thinner because you're expected, and competencies, I guess, is the important word, they're expected to have competencies as a filmmaker, short film, you know, music producer. You're expected to have this engaging persona, which creates this artist profile, this story around you. So there's all that downward pressure in terms of workload of filling content boxes. But as I said in the book, you know, there's this discomfort of putting yourself out there in a lot of ways, and how you present yourself, and whether you need to put that face on, or whether it's you being your authentic self, and what that means in terms of authenticity. I think obviously it's very different for different people.
It seems to be very much a generational thing as well.
Sure.
Well, except the concept of celebrity goes beyond this, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, that core element has been around for quite a long time.
But it was always very curated. Like the distance between the person and the star image, I feel, was greater than now.
Yeah, you usually had a lot more help in terms of cultivating things. And also you could be a little bit more enigmatic, I feel like, behind a little bit of a frosted glass. Whereas now it would be very, very difficult to build a kind of presence without giving of yourself large amounts of...
And young people... I hate that phrase.
Like you,
Mary. Excludes me. Young people are okay with that.
Yes,
you know, this is sort of this idea that I sort of almost wonder if privacy as a concept is something that has actually changed generationally.
I think that's a good point. I think perhaps some of the artists that had been in the industry for longer or were older, were less comfortable with, and they're grown up with a different sensibility of how they consumed music. So their idea of what an ideal artist is would be very different to a generation that was entirely brought up on TikTok.
That's interesting. Was that generational switch, that different attitude to music, that different attitude to digital tech, was that very noticeable within the artists you worked with, and was there almost a cutoff point?
Yes, and I think
you said yes really quickly there.
I think
we have a revelation here.
Yeah, perhaps that was one of the reasons as well why I ventured away a little bit, because you don't want to feel too much like the old guard a little bit, and I think there is an element of, you know, you need to stay really on top of that stuff in terms of a creative, in terms of how you create. And by the time I got to the end of my time as a co-writer, people were writing songs for TikTok. Mm-hmm. Specifically front-loaded hooks within the first, you know, 10 seconds, and it was all being manufactured in that way. And that wasn't something I felt particularly comfortable with. And maybe that was a generational shift that
I mean, we say generational, but it's almost half generational, quarter generational, isn't it?
The change has been so quick that I think it does have that kind of faster turnover. Yeah.
So we ask everyone this question. Has there been any criticism of the work? So you have this book that's come out. It's obviously you're most of it's factual, but it's also personal, and it's taking a particular stance on artistic value vis-a-vis the production and dissemination of it. Has anyone come out against this or complained?
No complaints. I mean, within review, I think there is an argument to be had for the fact that this is just a snapshot in time. As we've kind of discussed, this is rapidly changing. You can't...
And you are very clear in the book.
Yeah, you can't write a definitive argument about the state of the industry that's going to continue on. And even now, I can see parts of the book which probably need updating. The inspiration for the book started from Keith Negus, who was an academic. He wrote a book called Producing Pop in 1992. And it's this window into the world of the peak of the traditional music industry. And I always thought that was fascinating, this idea of, you know, let's just create a snapshot of where we are. Other than that, there wasn't really any pushback, but I can certainly see that it's a snapshot. It's not a definitive kind of idea of how you should operate moving forward.
Hmm. What are your plans next then? After we have this little snapshot,
what's the next one?
Yeah, I guess papers. You know, I've been busy writing a lot of papers. I did enjoy the book. I really enjoyed the process. I don't know if a lot of people enjoy the process of books, but I think for me it was very enjoyable. So maybe at some point in the future, it would be nice to venture a little bit more into the weeds of perhaps a more focused part of the industry that I would like to.
So you would stay in the music industry as regards your research?
Yes, it's a little bit of my comfort zone, I guess. You know? But I like it. I find it an interesting space because it branches off into a lot of different areas. I think you can apply a lot of creative industries and theoretical sides to music. So it's a nice jump off point for me. And you know, all of these questions, you know, one of the papers I've just finished is about nostalgia and how we perceive you know, these old or dead formats that we used to look at, how that shapes our collective memory. So you can really use music as a coat hanger for exploring these issues.
Thank you very much, Richard.
Thanks, Richard. I have lots more questions, but we'll take them offline and hopefully we'll have you back again to discuss some of them.
It was very enjoyable.
Wish you all the best.
Yeah, thank you very much. Much appreciated.
With 110 academic staff from 22 countries and regions, the Faculty of Humanities and Social Science is committed to delivering world-class teaching and research, with a growing focus on interdisciplinary projects. Our faculty includes the School of Economics, the School of Education and English, the School of International Communications, and the School of International Studies, as well as the Language Center.
We are committed to internationally renowned and excellent research in a thriving transdisciplinary environment of outstanding individual and collective research. Our faculty is home to a number of groundbreaking projects, including but not limited to digital heritage, game cultures, the historical and contemporary Silk Roads, health economics, cognitive neuroscience of language, and gender studies.
The Faculty of Humanities and Social Science is also proud to host a high percentage of international staff who bring expertise to areas such as history, politics, journalism, media, and film studies, education, English, micro and macroeconomics, and more, as well as a wealth of experience from international universities.
We strive to offer an education and student experience reflecting the most up-to-date knowledge and achieve this through the close integration of teaching and research. Our research-led teaching places cutting-edge knowledge at the center of our curriculum, while our academic staff actively engage our students in their ongoing research activities.